There is a shrine in the kitchen. It is set in a cupboard whose door he has replaced with a fretwork arch. The arch partly hides the yellow light bulb that in the evenings lights up the shrine. Two pictures rest behind a small altar. To the side, Ganesha again, and in the center, in a larger frame, smiling and blue-skinned, Krishna playing the flute. Both have smears of red and yellow powder on the glass over their foreheads. In a copper dish on the altar are three silver murtis, representations. He identifies them for me with a pointed finger. Lakshmi, Shakti, the mother goddess, in the form of Parvati, and Krishna, this time as a playful baby crawling on all fours. In between the goddesses is a stone Shiva Yoni Linga, which looks like half an avocado with a phallic stump rising from its center, a Hindu symbol celebrating the male and female energies of the universe. To one side of the dish is a small conch shell set on a pedestal. To the other, a small silver handbell. Grains of rice lie about, as well as a flower just beginning to wilt. Many of these items are anointed with dabs of yellow and red. On the shelf below are various articles of devotion. A beaker full of water, a copper spoon, a lamp with a wick coiled in oil, sticks of incense, and small bowls full of red powder, yellow powder, grains of rice, and lumps of sugar. There is another Virgin Mary in the dining room. Upstairs in his office, there is a brass Ganesha sitting cross-legged next to the computer, a wooden Christ on the cross from Brazil on a wall, and a green prayer rug in a corner. The Christ is expressive. He suffers. The prayer rug lies in its own clear space. Next to it, on a low bookstand, is a book covered by a cloth. At the center of the cloth is a single Arabic word, intricately woven, four letters, an aleph, two lambs, and a ha. The word God in Arabic. The book on the bedside table is a Bible. Chapter 16.
We are all born like Catholics, aren't we? In limbo, without religion, until some figure introduces us to God. After that meeting, the matter ends for most of us. If there is a change, it is usually for the lesser rather than the greater. Many people seem to lose God along life's way. That was not my case. The figure in question for me was an older sister of mother's, of a more traditional mind, who brought me to a temple when I was a small baby. Auntie Rohini was delighted to meet her newborn nephew and thought she would include Mother Goddess in the delight.
"It will be his symbolic first outing," she said. "It's a samskara."
Symbolic indeed. We were in Madurai. I was the fresh veteran of a 7-hour train journey. No matter. Off we went on this Hindu rite of passage, mother carrying me, auntie propelling her. I have no conscious memory of this first go-around in a temple, but some smell of incense, some play of light and shadow, some flame, some burst of color, something of the sultriness and mystery of the place must have stayed with me. A germ of religious exaltation, no bigger than a mustard seed, was sown in me and left to germinate. It has never stopped growing since that day. I am a Hindu because of sculptured cones of red kumkum powder and baskets of yellow turmeric nuggets, because of garlands of flowers and pieces of broken coconut, because of the clanging of bells to announce one's arrival to God, because of the whine of the reedy nadaswaram and the beating of drums, because of the patter of bare feet against stone floors down dark corridors pierced by shafts of sunlight, because of the fragrance of incense, because of flames of aarti lamps circling in the darkness,
because of bhajans being sweetly sung, because of elephants standing around to bless, because of colorful murals telling colorful stories, because of foreheads carrying, variously signified, the same word, faith. I became loyal to these sense impressions even before I knew what they meant or what they were for. It is my heart that commands me so. I feel at home in a Hindu temple. I am aware of presence, not personal the way we usually feel presence, but something larger. My heart still skips a beat when I catch sight of the murti, of God residing in the inner sanctum of a temple. Truly, I am in a sacred cosmic womb, a place where everything is born, and it is my sweet luck to behold its living core. My hands naturally come together in reverent worship. I hunger for prasad, that sugary offering to God that comes back to us as a sanctified treat. My palms need to feel the heat of a hallowed flame whose blessing I bring to my eyes and forehead. But religion is more than rite and ritual. There is what the rite and ritual stand for. Here too, I am a Hindu. The universe makes sense to me through Hindu eyes. There is Brahman, the world soul, the sustaining frame upon which is woven, warp and weft, the cloth of being, with all its decorative elements of space and time. There is Brahman Nirguna, without qualities, which lies beyond understanding, beyond description, beyond approach. With our poor words, we sow a suit for it. One, truth, unity, absolute, ultimate reality, round of being, and try to make it fit, but Brahman Nirguna always bursts the seams. We are left speechless. But there is also Brahman Shaguna, with qualities where the suit fits. Now we call it Shiva, Krishna, Shakti, Ganesha. We can approach it with some understanding. We can discern certain attributes, loving, merciful, frightening, and we feel the gentle pull of relationship. Brahman Shaguna is Brahman made manifest to our limited senses. Brahman expressed not only in gods, but in humans, animals, trees, in a handful of earth, for everything has a trace of the divine in it. The truth of life is that Brahman is no different from Atma, the spiritual force within us, what you might call the soul. The individual soul touches upon the world soul like a well reaches for the water table. That which sustains the universe beyond thought and language, and that which is at the core of us and struggles for expression, is the same thing. The finite within the infinite. The infinite within the finite. If you ask me how Brahman and Atma relate precisely, I would say in the same way the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit relate. Mysteriously. But one thing is clear. Atma seeks to realize Brahman, to be united with the Absolute, and it travels in this life on a pilgrimage where it is born and dies, and is born again and dies again, and again and again, until it manages to shed the sheath that imprison it here below. The paths to liberation are numerous, but the bank along the way is always the same. The bank of karma, where the liberation account of each of us is credited or debited depending on our actions. This, in a holy nutshell, is Hinduism. And I have been a Hindu all my life. With its notions in mind, I see my place in the universe. But we should not cling. A plague upon fundamentalists and literalists. I am reminded of a story of Lord Krishna when he was a cowherd. Every night, he invites the milkmaids to dance with him in the forest. They come and they dance. The night is dark, the fire in their midst roars and crackles, the beat of the music gets ever faster. The girls dance and dance and dance with their sweet lord, who has made himself so abundant as to be in the arms of each and every girl. But the moment the girls become possessive, the moment each one imagines that Krishna is her partner alone, he vanishes. So it is that we should not be jealous with God. I know a woman here in Toronto who is very dear to my heart. She was my foster mother. I call her Auntie G, and she likes that. She's Quebecois. Though she has lived in Toronto for over 30 years, her French-speaking mind still slips on occasion on the understanding of English sounds. And so, when she first heard of Hare Krishnas, she didn't hear right. She heard hairless Christians, and that is what they were to her for many years. When I corrected her, I told her that in fact she was not so wrong. That Hindus, in their capacity for love, are indeed hairless Christians, just as Muslims, in the way they see God in everything, are bearded Hindus, and Christians, in their devotion to God, are hat-wearing Muslims. Chapter 17. First wonder goes deepest. Wonder after that fits in the impression made by the first. I owe to Hinduism the original landscape of my religious imagination, those towns and rivers, battlefields and forests, holy mountains and deep seas where gods, saints, villains and ordinary people rub shoulders and in doing so define who and why we are. I first heard of the tremendous cosmic might of loving kindness in this Hindu land. It was Lord Krishna speaking. I heard him, and I followed him. And in his wisdom and perfect love, Lord Krishna led me to meet one man. I was 14 years old, and a well-content Hindu on a holiday, when I met Jesus Christ. It was not often that Father took time off from the zoo, but one of the times he did, we went to Munnar, just over in Kerala. Munnar is a small hill station surrounded by some of the highest tea estates in the world. It was early May, and the monsoon hadn't come yet. The plains of Tamil Nadu were beastly hot. We made it to Munnar after a winding 5-hour car ride from Madurai. The coolness was as pleasing as having mint in your mouth. We did the tourist thing. We visited a Tata tea factory. We enjoyed a boat ride on a lake. We toured a cattle breeding center. We fed salt to some Nilgiri tars, a species of wild goat in a national park. "We have some in our zoo. You should come to Pondicherry," said Father to some Swiss tourists. Ravi and I went for walks in the tea estates near town. It was all an excuse to keep our lethargy a little busy. By late afternoon, Father and Mother were as settled in the tea room of our comfortable hotel as two cats sunning themselves at a window. Mother read, while Father chatted with fellow guests. There are 3 hills within Munnar. They don't bear comparison with the tall hills, mountains you might call them, that surround the town, but I noticed the first morning, as we were having breakfast, that they did stand out in one way. On each stood a godhouse. The hill on the right, across the river from the hotel, had a Hindu temple high on its side. The high in the middle, further away, held up a mosque, while the hill on the left was crowned with a Christian church. On our 4th day in Munnar, as the afternoon was coming to an end, I stood on the hill on the left. Despite attending a nominally Christian school, I had not yet been inside a church, and I wasn't about to dare the deed now. I knew very little about the religion. It had a reputation for few gods and great violence. But good schools. I walked around the church. It was a building unremittingly unrevealing of what it held inside, with thick, featureless walls pale blue in color and high, narrow windows impossible to look in through. A fortress. I came upon the rectory. The door was open. I hid around a corner to look upon the scene. To the left of the door was a small board with the words Parish Priest and Assistant Priest on it. Next to each was a small sliding block. Both the priest and his assistant were in, the board informed me in gold letters, which I could plainly see. One priest was working in his office, his back turned to the bay windows, while the other was seated on a bench at a round table in the large vestibule that evidently functioned as a room for receiving visitors. He sat facing the door and the windows, a book in his hands, a Bible, I presumed. He read a little, looked up, read a little more, looked up again. It was done in a way that was leisurely, yet alert and composed. After some minutes, he closed the door and put it aside. He folded his hands together on the table and sat there, his expression serene, showing neither expectation nor resignation. The vestibule had clean white walls, the table and the benches were of dark wood, and the priest was dressed in a white cassock. It was all neat, plain, simple. I was filled with a sense of peace. But more than the setting, what arrested me was my intuitive understanding that he was there, open, patient, in case someone, anyone, should want to talk to him. A problem of the soul, a heaviness of the heart, a darkness of the conscience, he would listen with love. He was a man whose profession it was to love, and he would offer comfort and guidance to the best of his ability. I was moved. What I had before my eyes stole into my heart and thrilled me. He got up. I thought he might slide his block over, but he didn't. He retreated further into the rectory, that's all, leaving the door between the vestibule and the next room as open as the outside door. I noted this, how both doors were wide open. Clearly, he and his colleague were still available. I walked away, and I dared. I entered the church. My stomach was in knots. I was terrified I would meet a Christian who would shout at me, "What are you doing here? How dare you enter this sacred place, you defiler? Get out right now!" There was no one, and little to be understood. I advanced and observed the inner sanctum. There was a painting. Was this the Murti? Something about a human sacrifice, an angry god who had to be appeased with blood. Dazed women staring up in the air and fat babies with tiny wings flying about. A charismatic bird. Which one was the god? To the side of the sanctum was a painted wooden sculpture. The victim again, bruised and bleeding in bold colors. I stared at his knees. They were badly scraped. The pink skin was peeled back and looked like the petals of a flower, revealing kneecaps that were fire engine red. It was hard to connect this torture scene with the priest in the rectory. The next day, at around the same time, I let myself in. Catholics have a reputation for severity, for judgment that comes down heavily. My experience with Father Martin was not at all like that. He was very kind. He served me tea and biscuits in a tea set that tinkled and rattled at every touch. He treated me like a grown-up. And he told me a story. Or rather, since Christians are so fond of capital letters, a story. And what a story. The first thing that drew me in was disbelief. What? Humanity sins, but it's God's Son who pays the price. I tried to imagine Father saying to me, "Piscine, a lion slipped into the llama pen today and killed two llamas. Yesterday another one killed a black buck. Last week two of them ate the camel. The week before it was painted storks and grey herons. And who's to say for sure who snacked on our golden agouti? The situation has become intolerable. Something must be done. I have decided that the only way the lions can atone for their sins is if I feed you to them."
"Yes, Father. That would be the right and logical thing to do. Give me a moment to wash up."
"Hallelujah, my son.
Hallelujah, Father.
What a downright weird story. What peculiar psychology. I asked for another story, one that I might find more satisfying. Surely this religion had more than one story in its bag. Religions abound with stories. But Father Martin made me understand that the stories that came before it, and there were many, were simply prologue to the Christians. Their religion had one story, and to it they came back again and again, over and over. It was story enough for them. I was quiet that evening at the hotel. That a god should put up with adversity, I could understand. The gods of Hinduism face their fair share of thieves, bullies, kidnappers, and usurpers. What is the Ramayana but the account of one long bad day for Rama? Adversity, yes. Reversals of fortune, yes. Treachery, yes. But humiliation? Death? I couldn't imagine Lord Krishna consenting to be stripped naked, whipped, mocked, dragged through the streets, and, to top it off, crucified, at the hands of mere humans to boot. I'd never heard of a Hindu god dying. Brahman revealed did not go for deaths. Devils and monsters did, as did mortals, by the thousands and millions. That's what they were there for. Matter, too, fell away. But divinity should not be blighted by death. It's wrong. The world's soul cannot die, even in one contained part of it. It was wrong of this Christian god to let his avatar die. That is tantamount to letting a part of himself die. For if the Son is to die, it cannot be fake. If God on the cross is God shamming a human tragedy, it turns the passion of Christ into the farce of Christ. The death of the Son must be real. Father Martin assured me that it was. But once a dead God, always a dead God, even resurrected. The Son must have the taste of death forever in his mouth. The Trinity must be tainted by it. There must be a certain stench at the right hand of God the Father. The horror must be real. Why would God wish that upon himself? Why not leave death to the mortals? Why make dirty what is beautiful, spoil what is perfect? Love. That was Father Martin's answer. And what about this son's deportment? There is the story of baby Krishna, wrongly accused by his friends of eating a bit of dirt. His foster mother, Yashoda, comes up to him with a wagging finger. "You shouldn't eat dirt, you naughty boy," she scolds him.
"But I haven't,"
says the unchallenged lord of all and everything, in sport disguised as a frightened human child.
"Tut-tut! Open your mouth,"
orders Yashoda. Krishna does as he is told. He opens his mouth. Yashoda gasps. She sees in Krishna's mouth the whole, complete, entire, timeless universe. All the stars and planets of space and the distance between them. All the lands and seas of the earth and the life in them. She sees all the days of yesterday and all the days of tomorrow. She sees all ideas and all emotions, all pity and all hope, and the three strands of matter. Not a pebble, candle, creature, village, or galaxy is missing, including herself and every bit of dirt in its truthful place.
"My lord, you can close your mouth,"
she says reverently. There is the story of Vishnu, incarnated as Vamana the dwarf. He asks of Demon King Bali only as much land as he can cover in three strides. Bali laughs at this runt of a suitor and his puny request. He consents. Immediately, Vishnu takes on his full cosmic size. With one stride he covers the earth, with the second the heavens, and with the third he boots Bali into the netherworld. Even Rama, the most human of avatars, who had to be reminded of his divinity when he grew long-faced over the struggle to get Sita, his wife, back from Ravana, evil king of Lanka, was no slouch. No spindly cross would have kept him down.
When push came to shove, he transcended his limited human frame with strength no man could have and weapons no man could handle. That is God as God should be, with shine and power and might, such as can rescue and save and put down evil. This son, on the other hand, who goes hungry, who suffers from thirst, who gets tired, who is sad, who is anxious, who is heckled and harassed, who has to put up with followers who don't get it and opponents who don't respect him? What kind of a God is that? It's a God on too human a scale, that's what. There are miracles, yes, mostly of a medical nature, a few to satisfy hungry stomachs. At best a storm is tempered, water is briefly walked upon. If that is magic, it is minor magic, on the order of card tricks. Any Hindu god can do 100 times better. This son is a god who spent most of his time telling stories, talking. This son is a god who walked, a pedestrian god. And in a hot place at that, with a stride like any human stride, the sandal reaching just above the rocks along the way. And when he splurged on transportation, it was a regular donkey. This son is a god who died in 3 hours with moans, gasps, and laments. What kind of a god is that? What is there to inspire in this son? Love, said Father Martin. And this son appears only once long ago, far away? Among an obscure tribe in a backwater of West Asia on the confines of a long-vanished empire? Is done away with before he has a single grey hair on his head? Leaves not a single descendant, only scattered partial testimony, his complete works doodles in the dirt. Wait a minute. This is more than Brahman with a serious case of stage fright. This is Brahman selfish. This is Brahman ungenerous and unfair. This is Brahman practically unmanifest. If Brahman is to have only one son, he must be as abundant as Krishna with the milkmaids, no? What could justify such divine stinginess? Love, repeated Father Martin. I'll stick to my Krishna, thank you very much. I find his divinity utterly compelling. You can keep your sweaty, chatty son to yourself. That was how I met that troublesome rabbi of long ago, with disbelief and annoyance. I had tea with Father Martin 3 days in a row. Each time, as teacup rattled against saucer, as spoon tinkled against edge of cup, I asked questions. The answer was always the same. He bothered me, this son. Every day I burned with greater indignation against him, found more flaws to him. He's petulant. It's morning in Bethany, and God is hungry. God wants his breakfast. He comes to a fig tree. It's not the season for figs, so the tree has no figs. God is peeved. The son mutters, "May you never bear fruit again," and instantly the fig tree withers. So says Matthew, backed up by Mark. I ask you, is it the fig tree's fault that it's not the season for figs? What kind of a thing is that to do to an innocent fig tree? Wither it instantly. I couldn't get him out of my head. Still can't. I spent 3 solid days thinking about him. The more he bothered me, the less I could forget him. And the more I learned about him, the less I wanted to leave him. On our last day, a few hours before we were to leave Munnar, I hurried up the hill on the left. It strikes me now as a typically Christian scene. Christianity is a religion in a rush. Look at the world created in 7 days. Even on a symbolic level, that's creation in a frenzy. To one born in a religion where the battle for a single soul can be a relay race run over many centuries, with innumerable generations passing along the baton, the quick resolution of Christianity has a dizzying effect. If Hinduism flows placidly like the Ganges, then Christianity bustles like Toronto at rush hour. It is a religion as swift as a swallow, as urgent as an ambulance. It turns on a dime, expresses itself in the instant. In a moment, you are lost or saved. Christianity stretches back through the ages, but in essence, it exists only at one time. Right now. I booted up that hill. Though Father Martin was not in, alas, his block was slid over, thank God he was in. Short of breath, I said,
Father, I would like to be a Christian, please.
He smiled. You already are, Piscine. In your heart. Whoever meets Christ in good faith is a Christian. Here in Munnar, you met Christ. He patted me on the head. It was more of a thump, actually. His hand went boom, boom, boom on my head. I thought I would explode with joy. When you come back, we'll have tea again, my son.
Yes, Father.
It was a good smile he gave me. The smile of Christ. I entered the church without fear this time, for it was now my house too. I offered prayers to Christ, who is alive. Then I raced down the hill on the left and raced up the hill on the right to offer thanks to Lord Krishna for having put Jesus of Nazareth, whose humanity I found so compelling, in my way. Chapter 18. Islam followed right behind, hardly a year later. I was 15 years old, and I was exploring my hometown. The Muslim quarter wasn't far from the zoo. A small, quiet neighborhood with Arabic writing and crescent moons inscribed on the facades of the houses. I came to Mullah Street. I had a peek at the Jamia Masjid, the great mosque, being careful to stay on the outside, of course. Islam had a reputation worse than Christianity's. Fewer gods, greater violence, and I had never heard anyone say good things about Muslim schools, so I wasn't about to step in, empty though the place was. The building, clean and white, except for various edges painted green, was an open construction unfolding around an empty central room. Long straw mats covered the floor everywhere. Above, two slim fluted minarets rose in the air before a background of soaring coconut trees. There was nothing evidently religious or, for that matter, interesting about the place, but it was pleasant and quiet. I moved on. Just beyond the mosque was a series of attached single-story dwellings with small shaded porches. They were run down and poor, their stucco walls a faded green. One of the dwellings was a small shop. I noticed a lack of dusty bottles of Thumbs Up and four transparent plastic jars half full of candies. But the main ware was something else, something flat, roundish and white. I got close. It seemed to be some sort of unleavened bread. I poked at one. It flipped up stiffly. They looked like three-day-old naans. Who would eat these, I wondered. I picked one up and wagged it to see if it would break. A voice said, "Would you like to taste one?" I nearly jumped out of my skin. It's happened to all of us. There's sunlight and shade, spots and patterns of color, your mind is elsewhere, so you don't make out what is right in front of you. Not 4 feet away, sitting cross-legged before his breads, was a man. I was so startled, my hands flew up and the bread went sailing halfway across the street. It landed on a pat of fresh cow dung.
"I'm so sorry, sir. I didn't see you," I burst out.
I was just about ready to run away.
"Don't worry," he said calmly. "It will feed a cow. Have another one."
He tore one in two. We ate it together. It was tough and rubbery, real work for the teeth, but filling. I calmed down.
So you make these?
I said to make conversation.
Yes, here. Let me show you how.
He got off his platform and waved me into his house. It was a two-room hovel. The larger room, dominated by an oven, was the bakery, and the other, separated by a flimsy curtain, was his bedroom. The bottom of the oven was covered with smooth pebbles. He was explaining to me how the bread baked on these heated pebbles when the nasal call of the muezzin wafted through the air from the mosque. I knew it was the call to prayer, but I didn't know what it entailed. I imagined it beckoned the Muslim faithful to the mosque, much like bells summoned us Christians to church. Not so. The baker interrupted himself mid-sentence and said, "Excuse me." He ducked into the next room for a minute and returned with a rolled-up carpet, which he unfurled on the floor of his bakery, throwing up a small storm of flour. And right there before me, in the midst of his workplace, he prayed. It was incongruous, but it was I who felt out of place. Luckily, he prayed with his eyes closed. He stood straight. He muttered in Arabic. He brought his hands next to his ears, thumbs touching the lobes, looking as if he were straining to hear Allah replying. He bent forward. He stood straight again. He fell to his knees and brought his hands and forehead to the floor. He sat up. He fell forward again. He stood. He started the whole thing again. Why, Islam is nothing but an easy sort of exercise, I thought. Hot weather yoga for the Bedouins, asanas without sweat, heaven without strain. He went through the cycle four times, muttering throughout. When he had finished, with a right-left turning of the head and a short bout of meditation, he opened his eyes, smiled, stepped off his carpet, and rolled it up with a flick of the hand that spoke of old habit. He returned it to its spot in the next room. He came back to me.
"What was I saying?" he asked.
So it went the first time I saw a Muslim pray. Quick, necessary, physical, muttered, striking. Next time I was praying in church, on my knees, immobile, silent before Christ on the cross. The image of this calisthenic communion with God in the middle of bags of flour kept coming to my mind. Chapter 19. I went to see him again.
"What's your religion about?"
I asked. His eyes lit up.
"It is about the Beloved," he replied.
I challenge anyone to understand Islam, its spirit, and not to love it. It is a beautiful religion of brotherhood and devotion. The mosque was truly an open construction, to God and to Breeze. We sat cross-legged listening to the Imam until the time came to pray. Then the random pattern of sitters disappeared as we stood and arranged ourselves shoulder to shoulder in rows, every space ahead being filled by someone from behind until every line was solid and we were row after row of worshippers. It felt good to bring my forehead to the ground. Immediately, it felt like a deeply religious contact. Chapter 20. He was a Sufi, a Muslim mystic. He sought fana, union with God, and his relationship with God was personal and loving.
"If you take two steps toward God," he used to tell me, "God runs to you."
He was a very plain-featured man, with nothing in his looks or in his dress that made memory cry hark. I'm not surprised I didn't see him the first time we met. Even when I knew him very well, encounter after encounter, I had difficulty recognizing him.
His name was Satish Kumar. These are common names in Tamil Nadu, so the coincidence is not so remarkable. Still, it pleased me that this pious baker, as plain as a shadow and of solid health, and the communist biology teacher and science devotee, the walking mountain on stilts, sadly afflicted with polio in his childhood, carried the same name. Mr. and Mr. Kumar taught me biology and Islam. Mr. and Mr. Kumar led me to study zoology and religious studies at the University of Toronto. Mr. and Mr. Kumar were the prophets of my Indian youth. We prayed together and we practiced dhikr, the recitation of the 99 revealed names of God. He was a hafiz, one who knows the Quran by heart, and he sang it in a slow, simple chant. My Arabic was never very good, but I loved its sound. The guttural eruptions and long flowing vowels rolled just beneath my comprehension like a beautiful brook. I gazed into this brook for long spells of time. It was not wide, just one man's voice, but it was as deep as the universe. I described Mr. Kumar's place as a hovel. Yet no mosque, church, or temple ever felt so sacred to me. I sometimes came out of that bakery feeling heavy with glory. I would climb onto my bicycle and pedal that glory through the air. One such time, I left town and on my way back, at a point where the land was high and I could see the sea to my left and down the road a long ways, I suddenly felt I was in heaven. The spot was, in fact, no different from when I had passed it not long before, but my way of seeing it had changed. The feeling, a paradoxical mix of pulsing energy and profound peace, was intense and blissful. Whereas before the road, the sea, the trees, the air, the sun, all spoke differently to me, now they spoke one language of unity. Tree took account of road, which was aware of air, which was mindful of sea, which shared things with sun. Every element lived in harmonious relation with its neighbor, and all was kith and kin. I knelt a mortal. I rose an immortal. I felt the center of a small circle coinciding with the center of a much larger one. Atma met Allah. One other time, I felt God come so close to me. It was in Canada, much later. I was visiting friends in the country. It was winter. I was out alone on a walk on their large property and returning to the house. It was a clear, sunny day after a night of snowfall. All nature was blanketed in white. As I was coming up to the house, I turned my head. There was a wood, and in that wood, a small clearing. A breeze, or perhaps it was an animal, had shaken a branch. Fine snow was falling through the air, glittering in the sunlight. In that falling golden dust, in that sun-splashed clearing, I saw the Virgin Mary. Why her, I don't know. My devotion to Mary was secondary. But it was her. Her skin was pale. She was wearing a white dress and a blue cloak. I remember being struck by their pleats and folds. When I say I saw her, I don't quite mean it literally, though she did have body and color. I felt I saw her, a vision beyond vision. I stopped and squinted. She looked beautiful and supremely regal. She was smiling at me with loving kindness. After some seconds, she left me. My heart beat with fear and joy. The presence of God is the finest of rewards. Chapter 21.
I am sitting in a downtown cafe, after, thinking. I have just spent most of an afternoon with him. Our encounters always leave me weary of the glum contentment that characterizes my life. What were those words he used that struck me? Ah, yes, dry, yeastless factuality. The better story. I take pen and paper out and write. Words of divine consciousness. Moral exaltation. Lasting feelings of elevation, elation, joy. A quickening of the moral sense, which strikes one as more important than an intellectual understanding of things. An alignment of the universe along moral lines, not intellectual ones. A realization that the founding principle of existence is what we call love, which works itself out sometimes not clearly, not cleanly, not immediately, nonetheless, ineluctably. I pause. What of God's silence? I think it over. I add, an intellect confounded, yet a trusting sense of presence and of ultimate purpose. Chapter 22.
I can well imagine an atheist's last words. White, white, love, my God, and the deathbed leap of faith. Whereas the agnostic, if he stays true to his reasonable self, if he stays beholden to dry, yeastless factuality, might try to explain the warm light bathing him by saying, possibly a failing oxygenation of the brain, and to the very end, lack imagination and miss the better story.
Chapter 23.
Alas, the sense of community that a common faith brings to a people spells trouble for me. In time, my religious doings went from the notice of those to whom it didn't matter and only amused, to that of those to whom it did matter, and they were not amused. "What is your son doing going to temple?" asked the priest.
"Your son was seen in church crossing himself," said the imam.
"Your son has gone Muslim," said the pundit. Yes, it was all forcefully brought to the attention of my bemused parents. You see, they didn't know. They didn't know that I was a practicing Hindu, Christian, and Muslim. Teenagers always hide a few things from their parents, isn't that so? All 16-year-olds have secrets, don't they? But fate decided that my parents and I, and the three wise men, as I shall call them, should meet one day on the Guber Salai seaside esplanade, and that my secret should be outed. It was a lovely, breezy, hot Sunday afternoon, and the Bay of Bengal glittered under a blue sky. Townspeople were out for a stroll. Children screamed and laughed. Colored balloons floated in the air. Ice cream sales were brisk. Why think of business on such a day, I ask? Why couldn't they have just walked by with a nod and a smile? It was not to be. We were to meet not just one wise man, but all three, and not one after another, but at the same time, and each would decide upon seeing us that right then was the golden occasion to meet that Pondicherry notable, the zoo director, he of the model devout son. When I saw the first, I smiled. By the time I had laid eyes on the third, my smile had frozen into a mask of horror. When it was clear that all three were converging on us, my heart jumped before sinking very low. The wise men seemed annoyed when they realized that all three of them were approaching the same people. Each must have assumed that the others were there for some business other than pastoral, and had rudely chosen that moment to deal with it. Glances of displeasure were exchanged. My parents looked puzzled to have their way gently blocked by three broadly smiling religious strangers. I should explain that my family was anything but orthodox. Father saw himself as part of the new India, rich, modern, and as secular as ice cream. He didn't have a religious bone in his body. He was a businessman, pronounced busyness man in his case, a hard-working, earthbound professional, more concerned with inbreeding among the lions than any overarching moral or existential scheme. It's true that he had all new animals blessed by a priest, and there were two small shrines at the zoo, one to Lord Ganesha and one to Hanuman, gods likely to please a zoo director, what with the first having the head of an elephant and the second being a monkey, but Father's calculation was that this was good for business, not good for his soul, a matter of public relations rather than personal salvation. Spiritual worry was alien to him. It was financial worry that rocked his being. "One epidemic in the collection," he used to say, "and we'll end up in a road crew breaking up stones." Mother was mum, bored and neutral on the subject. A Hindu upbringing and a Baptist education had precisely cancelled each other out as far as religion was concerned, and had left her serenely impious. I suspect she suspected that I had a different take on the matter, but she never said anything when, as a child, I devoured the comic books of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and an illustrated children's Bible and other stories of the gods. She herself was a big reader. She was pleased to see me with my nose buried in a book, any book, so long as it wasn't naughty. As for Ravi, if Lord Krishna had held a cricket bat rather than a flute, if Christ had appeared more plainly to him as an umpire, if the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had chosen some notions of bowling, he might have lifted a religious eyelid. But they didn't, and so he slumbered. After the hellos and the good days, there was an awkward silence. The priest broke it when he said, with pride in his voice, "Bisseen is a good Christian boy. I hope to see him join our choir soon." My parents, the pundit, and the imam looked surprised.
"You must be mistaken. He's a good Muslim boy. He comes without fail to Friday prayer, and his knowledge of the Holy Quran is coming along nicely."
So said the imam. My parents, the priest, and the pundit looked incredulous. The pundit spoke. "You're both wrong. He's a good Hindu boy. I see him all the time at the temple coming for darshan and performing puja." My parents, the imam, and the priest looked astounded.
"There is no mistake," said the priest. "I know this boy. He is Bisseen Molitor Patel, and he's a Christian."
"I know him too, and I tell you he's a Muslim,"
asserted the imam.
"Nonsense," cried the pundit. "Bisseen was born a Hindu, lives a Hindu, and will die a Hindu."
The three wise men stared at each other, breathless and disbelieving. "Lord, avert their eyes from me," I whispered in my soul. All eyes fell upon me.
"Bisseen, can this be true?" said the imam earnestly. "Hindus and Christians are idolaters. They have many gods."
"And Muslims have many wives," responded the pundit.
The priest looked askance at both of them. "Bisseen," he nearly whispered, "there is salvation only in Jesus."
"Balderdash, Christians know nothing about religion," said the pundit.
"They strayed long ago from God's path," said the imam.
"Where's God in your religion?" snapped the priest. "You don't have a single miracle to show for it. What kind of religion is that without miracles?"
"It isn't a circus with dead people jumping out of tombs all the time, that's what. We Muslims stick to the essential miracle of existence. Birds flying, rain falling, crops growing. These are miracles enough for us."
"Feathers and rain are all very nice, but we like to know that God is truly with us."
"Is that so? Well, a whole lot of good it did God to be with you. You tried to kill him. You banged him to a cross with great big nails. Is that a civilized way to treat a prophet? The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, brought us the word of God without any undignified nonsense and died at a ripe old age.
The word of God? To that illiterate merchant of yours in the middle of the desert? Those were drooling epileptic fits brought on by the swaying of his camel, not divine revelation. That, or the sun frying his brains.
If the Prophet, PBUH, were alive, he would have choice words for you,
replied the Imam, with narrowed eyes.
Well, he's not. Christ is alive, while your old PBUH is dead, dead, dead.
The Pandit interrupted them quietly. In Tamil, he said,
The real question is, why is Pisin dallying with these foreign religions?
The eyes of the priest and the Imam properly popped out of their heads. They were both native Tamils.
God is universal,
spluttered the priest. The Imam nodded strong approval.
There is only one God.
And with their one God, Muslims are always causing troubles and provoking riots. The proof of how bad Islam is how uncivilized Muslims are,
pronounced the Pandit.
Says the slave driver of the caste system,
huffed the Imam.
Hindus enslave people and worship dressed-up dolls.
They are golden calf lovers. They kneel before cows,
the priest chimed in.
While Christians kneel before a white man. They are the flunkies of a foreign god. They are the nightmare of all non-white people.
And they eat pigs and are cannibals,
added the Imam for good measure.
What it comes down to,
the priest put out with cool rage,
is whether Pisin wants real religion or myths from a cartoon strip.
God or idols,
intoned the Imam gravely.
Our gods, or colonial gods, hissed the Pandit.
It was hard to tell whose face was more inflamed. It looked as if they might come to blows. Father raised his hands.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, please, he interjected. I would like to remind you there is freedom of practice in this country.
Three apoplectic faces turned to him.
Yes! Practice! Singular!
The wise men screamed in unison. Three index fingers, like punctuation marks, jumped to attention in the air to emphasize their point. They were not pleased at the unintended choral effect or the spontaneous unity of their gestures. Their fingers came down quickly, and they sighed and groaned each on his own. Father and mother stared on, at a loss for words. The Pandit spoke first.
Mr. Patel, Pisin's piety is admirable. In these troubled times, it's good to see a boy so keen on God. We all agree on that.
The Imam and the priest nodded.
But he can't be a Hindu, a Christian, and a Muslim. It's impossible. He must choose.
I don't think it's a crime. But I suppose you're right, Father replied.
The three murmured agreement and looked heavenward, as did Father, whence they felt the decision must come. Mother looked at me. A silence fell heavily on my shoulders.
Pisin?
Mother nudged me.
How do you feel about the question?
Papu Gandhi said all religions are true. I just want to love God,
I blurted out, and looked down, red in the face. My embarrassment was contagious. No one said anything. It happened that we were not far from the statue of Gandhi on the Esplanade. Stick in hand, an impish smile on his lips, a twinkle in his eyes, the Mahatma walked. I fancy that he heard our conversation, but that he paid even greater attention to my heart. Father cleared his throat and said in a half voice,
I suppose that's what we're all trying to do. Love God.
I thought it was very funny that he should say that. He who hadn't stepped into a temple with a serious intent since I had had the faculty of memory. But it seemed to do the trick.
You can't reprimand a boy for wanting to love God. The three wise men pulled away with stiff, grudging smiles on their faces. Father looked at me for a second, as if to speak, then thought better, said, "Ice cream, anyone?" and headed for the closet.